I'm gonna call. My name's Kenny.
Okay.
I've been clean and sober since January 5th of 1997, and for that, I'm especially grateful. And I did not know this was a Zoom, so this one's gonna really distract me. So wow. A couple of weeks ago, I guess it was about a month ago, someone asked me. We showed up to a Saturday meeting, and it was one of the regulars that I see at Remington, Dana, and she's like, "Oh, I was just talking about you." I was like, "Oh, you know," and she's like, "Oh, there's a guy here. He's a speaker getter." And I'm like, "Okay, yeah, I see where this is going." I was like, "Wow, there are no coincidences, because I've never seen her at the Saturday morning meeting, like ever in the past 3 years." So I always look at things as, you know, is it odd or is it God, you know? And so anyway, I was taught to share what it used to be like, what happened and what it's like today in a general way. And I know that the target of your meeting, which is the target of most speaker meetings, which is the last two paragraphs that you just read, which is to share in a general way, you know, about my experience, strength, and hope. And, you know, so it's funny because I thought about it. And I was thinking, and I get all these grandiose things that I want to say in my head over the last few weeks. Coming up here and thinking about it, and the first thing that comes to mind, I think about it when you talk about the last two paragraphs, is the 12th step. But I can't get to the 12th step unless I do the first step. So, you know, it's funny. I didn't choose to be an alcoholic. I didn't choose to have this lifestyle. But today, I choose to be an alcoholic, and I choose to have this lifestyle. And so, when I got sober, I'll predecess a little bit before I got sober. You know, I got sober in January of 97. And prior to that was the winter of 96. And prior to that was the summer of 96. And so I was at the pinnacle of my bottom. I was an active duty Marine. I was a young Marine. I was a young sergeant. And I was stationed in Iwakuni, Japan. And that was where I started hitting my bottom. I probably started hitting it a lot sooner, but I don't know if anybody's ever been overseas or been to Japan or foreign countries. But in Japan, they like to leave the bars open 24/7, and they have beer machines on all the corners. So it was like heaven for me. And, you know, that there's a lot of things that I did, and I won't spend too much time on Drunkalog. And, you know, being stationed in Iwakuni there was a place outside the front gate, and it was at Four Corners. And a buddy of mine, you know, one of my lower standard friends that I used to hang out with, because he always had money and I didn't. And we used to go hang out at this bar, and I used to have Purple Haze was a drink back then that they used to have, and it was laced with opium. And I know this Alcoholics Anonymous, but narcotics is part of my story. However, I will not base it off of that, but I just want to make sure that I'm understood as an alcoholic. So, you know, drinking all that stuff. And I remember waking up one time, and he and I woke up in the middle, and they had these big sewage ditches out there, and they're called Benjo ditches, and they're filled, and they're probably about 30, 40 feet wide, and flow through the center of town. And my buddy and I woke up about halfway in and halfway out of one of these ditches. And the only reason we woke up is because it was probably about 10 o'clock in the morning. The sun's beating down on us, and they had these little Japanese kids throwing rocks at us. And, you know, you wake up and it tastes like the cat box in your mouth and things like that. And so here we are, and I'm throwing up instantly because I'm covered, and we're both covered. And it's about another 3 kilometer walk back to base. And so we walked back to base, and the front guards wouldn't even let us in. They made us go behind the guard shack and rinse off with the hose while we stood there. And, you know, it was things like that. That's how I drank. You know, I blacked out in the end in most days. But, you know, it's funny how when I got sober, blacking out, I always started to remember. You know, the more and more I detoxed, the more and more I began to remember the incomprehensible demoralization that I went through. And so right around that time that I left Japan, I got orders back to California. And it was 29 Palms. I was supposed to be going to another school. And I get to this school, and I start hanging out with a couple of other friends who I consider, you know, lower in standards than me. And, you know, we did the same thing. And it's amazing that it passed. This was like a 3-month school. And this was the summer right after I got back. And I remember 2 weeks before I graduated school, I get this phone call. And it's this guy. His name is Sergeant Joubert. And he and I happened to have been stationed out in North Carolina together. And I didn't like Sergeant Joe Bear because he had about 12 years of sobriety and he had been going to AA all those years. And he had watched me drink from 18 to the time I left. You know, I was 18, I turned 19 in North Carolina. And I left North Carolina in the summer of 95. So he watched me, you know, go through the disease. And we worked side by side. And I hated him because he, it's not that he had all of his life together. It's how he took it in stride and how he managed things and how he worked his life when problems came about, that he didn't always turn to alcohol. Now, I didn't always turn to alcohol when problems got bad. And that wasn't until I hit my bottom. But right as I was hitting my bottom, I had left Japan. I went home on leave and I had gotten a young lady pregnant whom I was not romantically involved with, even though we were romantically involved with, you know, push comes to shove. I always claim that my daughter was conceived in love and that's how I always see it, you know. So anyway, I was on my way to being a father and here it was, you know, Sergeant Joe Bear's calling me. He's like, hey, I'm coming to your graduation. I'm going to be your sponsor. And because back then, you know, they gave you somebody to help you get acclimated to the new base and to the new position that you're going into. And so, you know, he tells me all this and he's enthusiastic about it. And I'm just cringing on the phone. It's a pay phone here in the barracks. And I'm just, oh, I hated this guy. And here we were peers now. I was a sergeant then. He was a sergeant. However, you know, I'm going to call him by his first name. Jeff was a bit older. He was a prior service guy. He was from, he spent time in the Coast Guard, got out of the Coast Guard, joined the Marine Corps. So when he joined the Marine Corps, he was in his 30s. He was late 30s. And I used to bag on him about how old he was. And I couldn't believe he made it, you know, and all those things. And he was probably about 6'5", and he was probably about 250 pounds. And, you know, I always made sure that when I was smart aleck and mouthy, that I was at least, you know, two arms length away from him. So his hands were the size of basketballs and, you know, and I was just a mouthy, irritable SOB back then. And so anyway, you know, Bear, he lived his life differently. And I always remembered that. And I never understood it, though. I didn't understand what AA was or sobriety. And every so often he'd mention things like that. And so anyway, he came out to my graduation. And this was November, August, September, October, November, October of 96. He came out to the graduation. Drove back to Barstow. I was getting stationed in Barstow. You know, if California ever has a you know, a behind hole, it's Barstow. I don't know if anybody's ever passed through Barstow, but it you know, I used to think that, and never heard of it. It's a logistics base out there. So anyway, I get stationed out there, and I'm working, you know, 20 feet from him at another desk. And this guy comes in happy and he's, you know, he's got his morning always started right. And I'm always coming in with DTs and shaking and, you know, pulling out the pint of tequila that I used to keep in my cargo pocket. And that's how I start my day. I take sips out of tequila, not thinking anybody noticed. And, you know, in the end, you know, this was the fall of 96. And I used to hang out with this guy named Tommy Hoffa from Michigan. And he and I used to hang out quite frequently. And there was a place called Who's On First in Barstow, California. It's on the corner of White Street and First Street. And so the reason why I bring that up is because now at the end of 129, down at 129 West White Street is the Alano Club that I never knew. But, you know, so Who's On First used to sit there. And Tommy and I used to frequent that place quite often. And we spent, you know, many a nights there in the last days of my bottom. And so now it's December of 96. And I went home. I was going home on leave and I was feeling pressured. Everybody wanted me to marry this young lady that I was not in love with and I didn't understand, you know, and didn't had all these emotions and feelings for. And I was quite numb. And in fact, that's where I preferred to stay in my last days. It wasn't fun for me drinking in the end, and for my bottom wasn't fun. I was miserable. I wanted to die. I had no soul left. I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief. And if you had something that I wanted, which was usually money, alcohol, or drugs, then I tried to take it. And I was your best friend. I'd sit on the bar stool, and if you were from Texas, I was from Texas. If you were from Jersey, I suddenly developed a Jersey accent. You know? And that's the kind of guy I was. You know, that's the kind of guy I drank with, was all those, you know, who I always considered lower. I didn't think you were ever on my level. You know, I was grandiose. You know, I grew up, joined Marine Corps at 17 and joined the biggest little boys club there was, you know. And I didn't drink a whole lot in high school, and I didn't start drinking until I joined the Marine Corps because I was this 126 scraggly pound kid, you know, left home. And then when I graduated boot camp, I was 170 pounds. You know, what the Marine Corps loves to tell you, your solid steel sex appeal, you know, and boy, that was first thing from the truth, you know. I was never those things. It was always that legend in my own mind type deal. And so about that time when I hit Barstow and all of that, and then I hit some vacation time to go home, it was right around Christmas. And my parents didn't want me home. You know, my dad, my stepmom, and there were a lot of people that did, and a lot of friends, you know, that I called friends. Coming home. We got tons of plans. And, you know, I had plans too. And my parents were leaving off to Texas. I'm split family. I go between Texas and Louisiana. My mom's from Texas and my dad's from Louisiana. And I'm half Cajun and half Texan. So I don't hold it against me. But so my parents went off to Texas to see family out there. And they told me I couldn't stay at the house. So I lied to them, found a place to stay. And as soon as they pulled out, you know, left driveway a couple hours, I took the screwdriver out and jimmied the lock on the door and got in the house. And so right about that time, sometime after Christmas, New Year's came along, everything was kind of a haze back then. I sat on the couch and I was suicidal. And I went and got my dad's shotgun and I was going to commit suicide. I didn't have any other hope left. And so when that happened, I didn't have the courage or the guts, thank God. There was something else working that day that told me not to do it, and I got drunk instead. And I woke up out of a blackout with my dad waking me up. It's time to go. Time to get in the van and head to New Orleans and get on a plane. And so I was getting back to get on a plane to head back to Barstow. And Tommy was going to pick me up, and he had my truck, which had no insurance on it. And you know, Barstow's about 2.5 hours, 3 hours from Vegas. And I hadn't made a payment on my truck in probably 6 months. And thank God I could park it on base where they couldn't repo it, you know. So anyway, I got back to Barstow. Tommy picked me up. I got back to Vegas, I should say. Vegas is where he picked me up. I hadn't had a drink. My dad dropped me off at the airport. I spent 7 hours waiting for the flight going through the DTs. For whatever reason, I didn't drink. I don't really remember the exact last day of my last drink. It was all a haze. It was right after New Year's, and somewhere around between January 4th and the 5th. And so anyway, I got to the counter there and the lady's there, and I said, "Hey, you know, I'm gonna pass out. Can you wake me up?" She goes, "Well, your flight doesn't leave for another 8 hours." She goes, "There'll be three more people here doing service." And I said, "All right." So anyway, I woke up, got on that plane, the red eye back to Vegas. And I'm sitting next to these two guys, and I'm by the window, and I'm looking out on the window, and all I could think about is Twilight Zone, and I was wishing that monster was out there chewing on the motor, and it just wasn't happening. And all I could do, and you know, I had grew up going to church, and I knew there was a God, and I had believed in a God at one time. However, I didn't always believe in him in the end. You know, I knew there was something bigger there, and I was angry at him, and how could he let me get this way, and how could my life go down in shambles? And you know, I was playing the victim, and it was everybody's fault. And so, you know, I thought I'd be the good guy and say, "Hey God, you know, if you let the plane go down, just take me and everybody else will be safe." And that didn't happen either. So I get back to Vegas, and Tommy picks me up, and Tommy wants to go party some more, and I was just done. I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't live my life that way. And Tommy passes out on the driver's side, and we get back around 4:30 in the morning. I carry him to his room, put him in his bed. I go back to my room. I get showered, get dressed, and I go, and I was wanting to drink bad. That's all I could think about was how can I just get out of my head, you know, because I hadn't had a drink in a few days. And I was shaking. I was throwing up, and I was pissing blood, and I was doing some things that weren't natural and normal, you know. And so I went to work, and I'm standing there, and I'm sweating bullets, and sweating. I'm sitting at my desk, and Jeff looks over at me, and he's looking at me, and I get up, because about this time I was about ready to just take a book and hit him in the head with it. And so I walk over to him, and I stand in front of his desk, and I'm standing there in the this guy is looking at me, and I said, I don't know what to do. And I broke down and I started crying. And he stood up and he grabbed me and he hugged me. And I wasn't ready for that. And I was very egotistical, you know, macho, all this stuff. You know, men don't hug men. Men don't hold hands. They don't say, I love you. You know, I grew up with a tough father, you know, and a tough grandfather and machismo. And I'm not saying that men can't be men today, but I can tell you from being sober that I've changed some of those things. So once he hugged me, I just fell limp, and he grabbed me and he said, come go along with me. Those were the exact words. And he took me, we went into the front office and he said, hey, I'm taking this guy to see Chuck. Chuck was his sponsor at the time. And he took me to this other office space on base and sat down, and Chuck started asking me all these questions. And I thought, man, this is like the Spanish Inquisition. And you know, he started asking me, he's like, well, how much do you drink? I was like, boy, never thought I ever kept track. I was like, if it's in front of me, that's where it's going inside of me. You know, I was that guy that never looked at the picture as half full, it's half empty, and when's it going to be full again? You know, and I was that guy that walked around a bar, and if you left your cup or beer or bottle unattended, I was drinking it, and I was waited for people to go to the dance floor because that was prime time, you know. And the bartenders used to laugh because it made them money, and they would always see me coming. And they knew, you know, my regular places. And that's the kind of guy I was. And so, you know, he starts asking me questions like how many blackouts and things like that. So, well, I don't know. You know, I was supposed to keep count of those things either. You know, so he's laughing. And I'm like, I was getting pissed. This guy's laughing at me. You know, doesn't he know who I am? Now my ego starts to come out. It's like, oh, I don't need help. I don't need this. And I don't need anything. And so he's like, we're going to go to a meeting, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, okay. I said, that's the last thing I want to do. I said, but let's go. You know, I said, well, there's a bunch of old men sitting around in a meeting. Because that was my mindset, was a bunch of old men sat around and talked shit. You know, excuse my language. I apologize. So that's what happened. We went to a meeting, and I just remember nothing. You know, I just remember sitting in there and people were laughing and people, you know, were sharing about problems with solution. And I didn't understand that because every problem I had, I tried to solve with alcohol. And, you know, I tried to drink my problems away. I tried to do everything in my life that involved alcohol, and steadily found out that that's not how my life can go, because left to me, you know, it's just like the first step says, unmanageability. So going through the steps, first part of that first step was easy for me in the beginning. I knew what I needed. I didn't know if I wanted it yet. And I had to understand what it was that I wanted. I just know what I wanted, what I couldn't keep doing what I was doing. And so to be able to do that and to just hang on by a thread and go from being suicidal and to drinking every day. And there was a book talks about it, you know, the mental obsession. And that's exactly what I understood about it is that I could not stop thinking about it. I didn't want to drink it, but I wanted to drink so bad because that's all I ever knew. And everything there was. And I was a high functioning alcoholic. I could go to work. I could perform my job. I was a comm guy, a data guy. I could load servers and networks and do all this new stuff that was new age coming along in the late 90s. And I could do all of that, you know, and still go out and run 3 miles in less than 20 minutes. And I could do all these things throwing up, you know, and I stayed drunk doing all these things. And, you know, the funny thing about it was I always thought nobody knew, you know, the great lies that somebody knew. So the unmanageability started to rear its head when I started listening to the stories that people were sharing and I started identifying. You know, and I didn't have a sponsor, and the guy that became my sponsor was Jeff. And, you know, so that's what happened, you know, it's what it used to be like. And then that's what happened. What happened was, is that something bigger than me intervened. And at that point, I didn't believe it was God. I believed in a group of drunks. And I heard that saying often in the meetings, you know, you don't want to believe in God, just believe in a group of drunks for now, you know? And so I knew that there was always something bigger, and I had believed in that. And, you know, so being able to understand that early on, and after going through the DTs and suffering that for about a week and a half, and then going to meetings, and then asking Jeff to be my sponsor, and I asked him to be my sponsor. I hadn't identified as an alcoholic. I was probably about 20 days in, and there was a speaker meeting with my grand sponsor Chuck, and was with another men's group. And I got sober in a men's stag meeting called the Los Coyotes Men's Group out of Barstow, California, who was affiliated with another, with the oldest men's group in Anaheim, California, Orange County, called the Dog on the Roof Group. And, you know, we used to go down there to the men's meeting on Thursdays. And so anyway, they had asked Chuck to speak at one of these outside meetings that they were hosting. And so Chuck was speaking, and there was this guy named Ruben. And Ruben had about 10, 11, 12 years. I don't remember exactly. And so I'm sitting there. I'm thinking, yeah, it's a speaker meeting. I don't got to do nothing. And Ruben asks me to read. And that was my first resentment at someone in AA. But that's a lie, because I resented everybody who walked through the doors. And Ruben asked me to read How It Works. And, you know, I got about three sentences into How It Works, and something just hit me. And, you know, the book talks about that spiritual experience. And that's what I believe when I had my first real spiritual experience. And then I started recalling how I, you know, how I went to stand in front of somebody and ask for help. Because that wasn't me. You know, my ego didn't allow me to ask for help. I asked no one for help. I figured it out on my own. I did everything on my own. And I didn't know how to let go. I didn't know how to do anything other than the job the Marine Corps taught me, and get drunk. In the end, and, you know, so being able to understand that and read that, and then sit there in silence, and I don't even think I heard a word Chuck said. All I could keep fixating on was all of chapter 5, you know, reading that, how it works. And then I had all these questions, and you know, the ride home, I just had question, and the ride home seemed like 10 minutes, and it was a good hour and a half away, because we lived up in Barstow, and we'd always drive down to Orange County. And, you know, that's when I had asked Bear to be my sponsor. I didn't know what it was that I was going to do. And the first words out of his mouth after that was, what are you willing to do for your sobriety? You know? I was like, well, I don't know. I don't understand that term. You know, I don't understand sobriety. And he laughed, and I got irritated, as I often did at him, because it seemed like he always had all the answers. And the longer I began to stay sober, I realized that it wasn't him that had all the answers. You know, it was the experience, strength, and hope of others. It was him being a sponsor to me. It was him being sponsored, you know, and it was him being a part of a home group. And so understanding that first part of that first step, and accepting that, and understanding that second part, and then allowing myself, and to sum up the first three steps, I can't, he can't, so letting him. And then allowing something to work in my life, you know. And at that time, my higher power became a group, you know. And I became a member of a home group. And then, man, he hits me with, huh, once you start making lists. Man, making lists, what's all this work, you know? I just want to go have fun. I want the promises. I want all this stuff as I thought should be instantly gratifying. And, you know, so right about the time, the summer of 97, I started my fourth step. And we used to go on this camp out, it was a men's camp out. And so I started working on my fourth step there. And I had all these lists. Once I started, man, I could not stop. Once I got the hang of, well, I'm identifying all my stuff. And then realizing, like, whoa, I hit a brick wall, because I did not want to share some of my deepest, darkest secrets. You know, and this is, you know, AA taught me how to be transparent, and taught me also not to come up to a podium and share my fifth step either, but to share experience, strength, and hope, with problems, with solution. And, you know, going through that first four step, I learned what defects were. And my sponsor said to me, Bear said to me, he goes, hey, man, you're never going to catch everything this first go round. And I was like, what, I got to do this again? And he laughed. He's like, well, you expect to stay sober. And he goes, but I don't think you will. So he knew how to motivate me, because, see, I was that ego. So he started using some of my defects against me. And so I did the fourth step, and then it came time for fifth step time. And I remember I wrote out all this stuff, and I wrote out all this garbage on the page. And I looked at my part in it, and, man, every time that I got to my part in it, I got sick to my stomach. And, you know, because I had to disregard what anybody did to me or said to me, acted upon me, you know. I couldn't be the victim no more. I had to take responsibility for my own actions. And I didn't like it. It was probably the most painful thing I'd ever experienced in my life since I was a teenager. And, you know, because I was a scared little boy who grew up to be a scared little boy. And that's what I realized. You know? And it came time to sit down with him and do that fifth step. And I went through all these things. And I went through all this. And he asked me about name after name after name. And I would try to go into, well, their fault. He wouldn't let me. And then we'd talk. And he'd look at it. He'd read. And we finally got to the end. And I expected him to say some profound stuff. I wanted him to say something profound, you know. And I was like, yeah, this guy's got all the answers. And he looked at me and laughed. He goes, you know what? He's like, you got the worst handwriting of anybody I've ever seen. I was just pissed, you know. And I was like, man. I was like, this has got to be. He's like, no. He's like, come on. We're going to go get some ice cream first. We're going to go stop by Chuck's house. And he's like, we're going to sit down and we're going to say some prayers. And so we went to my grand sponsor's house and we did fifth, sixth, and seventh. Mm. And, you know, we did some prayers and we had some ice cream. And so now, you know, I thought, wow. And he's like, all right. So, you know, what are you going to do now? Well, you got to stay doing this. You know, this doesn't stop, you know. And that was where the work really began because, you know, I was going to a lot of meetings every day, actually. I did the 90 and 90. I don't even think it was ever suggested to me. I might have heard it once or twice, but I stayed active every day. Every day we were at a meeting, sometimes two meetings a day on a weekend. And, you know, that's where I learned how to be a part of something. That's where I learned that I didn't always have to remain angry. You know, my defects didn't disappear overnight. And, you know, going through the steps and doing those things doesn't make you a perfect person. And I understood that years later. So being able to do that, and we used to go to this place called the Howe House. It was a little detox place in Victorville, California. And it was a 90-day inpatient program. And Bear said, well, you got to start working with others. It's like just going to meetings and sharing isn't enough. You got to start working with others, you know. You got to start giving it back. And I didn't really understand what that meant. And so we're at the Howe House one evening. And that time the meeting was an hour and a half. So they did a break in between. They used to let them go outside and smoke. And we could mingle with them for about 15 minutes and go back in for the meeting. And there was this kid named Matt. And my sponsor's like, go over there and tell him you're going to be a sponsor. I was like, I don't want to sponsor anybody. And he grabbed me by the shoulder and led me over there and said, Matt, this is Kenny. He's looking for somebody to sponsor. So, you know, I talked to Matt and I started sponsoring Matt. And, you know, this was right around the time my daughter was being born, right after that. She had been born. I wasn't home for that and I hadn't gone home. And I had a trip planned to go see my daughter because now I'm sober and I need to show everybody how sober I am. You know? Look at me. I've cleaned up my life. You need to instantly forgive me. Allow me back in and not be so angry at me because I'm doing something different. And so anyway, I start sponsoring Matt and then I take a trip home to meet my newborn baby and have all these pulls, you know. I got my mom and dad and everybody telling me, what do you need to go to a meeting for? You need to be a dad. You need to make an honest man out of yourself and be a father and do all these things. And you need to marry this girl. And they were still pushing this. And everybody was still pushing it. And I was home all of 3 days. And I paid about $650 to get my ticket changed. And I flew back because I got awfully thirsty. And, you know, and I didn't listen to sponsor guidance and direction. You see, what I understood about being somebody sponsoring you was that my sponsor wasn't there to make my decisions for me. I make all my own decisions, and he wasn't there, but he was there to guide me. And there were some times when he'd poke his finger in my chest, and sometimes he had to speak louder than the disease. And there were some times where he didn't say anything at all, and he allowed me to make my foolish decision and to decide whether or not I was going to stay or run. And there were many times I wanted to run. And I'm grateful that regardless of how much I still hated him. He was probably number three on my resentment list. you know, I hadn't worked through that resentment at all with him. Even though I loved him, you know, it was kind of ironic, you know, because I loved him and I hated him. And it was a love-hate relationship for me. So anyway, you know, I flew back, and he picked me up from the airport, this time in Vegas. And we had that long talk on the ride back, which, you know, I didn't want to do. I wanted to sleep, and he would not let me. And I remember things like that in my early sobriety. And he talked about the work that I had to put in. And so being a father, I was becoming a father, and I didn't know how to be a father. And I got an opportunity to move off base with another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. His name was Robert. And Robert had a little boy, was six years old. And there was another guy that came into our group named Honus. And Honus and I became quick best friends because he was just as sick as I was. And he had two kids. And he had a little boy and a little girl, and Eric was, I think, 3 at the time, and Brittany was, I think, 6 or 7. And so anyway, you know, being a part of this men's group and learning things, and as I talked about this group down in Anaheim, we'd go religiously every Thursday down to this meeting and be a part of, you know, that. And there was a guy down there by the name of Rob Griggs. And Rob, God rest his soul, he died sober. He died of cancer. He died a few years back. But Rob was one of the few guys that come up to me. And the first thing he asked was, "Hey, how you doing? How's your daughter?" You know, and I would always give the side of, "Well, you know, I don't know." And da, da, da. He'd look at me. He's like, "You see all these kids sometimes at the meeting? You know, the guys in your group." He's like, "You learn how to be a father watching other sober members be a father." You know, And so that's where I began to learn how God was working in my life without really knowing, you know. And so I got to be a father to other people's kids and Honus's kids and Robert's kid. And doing that and learning how to do those things. And when it was time, you know, I'd get to be the father. And my sponsor's telling me, you can't plan this. God's got it in store for you. And I used to hate it because I was still angry at God. He was still on my resentment list too, you know. And I hadn't worked through all those issues. And I call them issues. And today I just call them problems that I found solutions for. And learning how to be that father. Well, fast forward a little bit. I started dating, you know. I fell in love with a very sick Al-Anon, you know, a few lines. 10 women up against the wall, I'll pick the sickest one every time. And that's no disrespect to my wife. But the point is that I would find that sick one who was, you know, the rocks in her head would fit the holes in mine. So I found this Al-Anon. I got married and we didn't have kids. And we ended up in divorce because we both went against sponsor guidance and direction. You know, she went against her Al-Anon sponsor. They didn't tell us not to. And that was what we'd always banked on. We didn't say not to do this, you know, but they had always laid it out, you know, suggestion, and they laid out the whole thing. And they based everything off the program. And that used to piss me off. It's like, how convenient for people ever to lay it out on, you know, use the steps and the traditions and those types of things and being part of a group. And man, I didn't like that. You know, I hated the truth, you know, sometimes. So anyway, we ended up in divorce. And right around the time we ended up in divorce, my daughter's mother, whose name was Jamie, I don't call her my ex today. I don't call her my daughter's mother. I call her Jamie. And that's the respect I've learned in sobriety, you know, to work past resentments that I had at her, you know, because she had every right to be resentful at me. You know, I had, like the book talked about it, I went through her life like a tornado, and she was in love with me, and I didn't love her the same way. So anyway, Jamie and I became friends because she had finally moved on in life, and she was allowing me to be a part of my daughter's life. And I hadn't seen my daughter, and my daughter was going on 4 years old, and the most I'd seen my daughter was a 2-week period out of 4 years. She was going to let me have her for the summer. This was the summer of 2001. And this was early 2001. And I had gotten orders to gotten married to this crazy sick Al-Anon. And we moved to Illinois. I was on recruiting duty of all things, you know, selling the Marine Corps to, you know, young, fit kids. And so here I am in Illinois going through a divorce and, uh, becoming friends with my daughter's mother, Jamie, and you know, she was in a committed relationship, and that made it great, you know. And I was sponsoring one guy at the time, and I was secretary of a meeting at the club there in LaSalle, Peru, Illinois. And all of a sudden, I get this phone call, and it's my dad, and he's like, "Jamie's dead." I'm like, "What?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "She was killed in a car wreck this morning." And instantly. So what had happened was, is Jamie had just dropped off Caitlin to her grandmother's house 5 minutes prior, and then got on the road to go to work. And airline highway, I don't know if you've ever been to Baton Rouge, but airline highway is two lane on one side, two lane on the other, with a big old divider in the middle that sinks down a little bit. So this young teenage girl fiddling with the radio, missteps, speeding, trying to get wherever she's going. She clips a small little Ford Ranger, hits the median, and then flips and hits Jamie's car head on and kills Jamie instantly. And she flips a few more times, puts a few other people in the hospital. And the only thing happened to the young teenage girl, she broke her arm. And so that happened. And now everybody's like, "What are you going to do? What are you going to do?" Have a clue. So at the time, my sponsor was a guy named Ray in Illinois. And Ray's like, "You got to get a lawyer. You're going to have to do some things." And I was like, "Nope, I don't need a lawyer." And so about that time, my parents and Jamie's parents were going to fight custody for me, and they were going to keep Caitlin, because even though I'd been sober for a few years, nobody really believed, you know, because I wasn't around them. I had stayed sober out of state. And I was trying to allow myself to the actions of my, you know, to be my guide. And nobody believed me. And they were all going to fight me for custody. And so I did the right thing. And I talked to my sponsor and I did some inventories on it. And I was very fortunate that I had a lawyer that worked next to my office, and he pro bonoed and helped me to do the right thing. And so I went home for the funeral, and I got to make amends to Jamie. And I was a pallbearer at her funeral. And that same week, I'm sitting in the lawyer's office from her parents, and they had deceived me, and they were going to have me sign over all the rights without me knowing it. And so I'm sitting there with the lawyer, and the lawyer's asking me all these questions. And I'm like, "Well, you know, I just want my daughter. I don't care about insurance. I don't care about money. It's like, I'm just going to be a father." So the lawyer looks at me and says, "Something ain't right here." And then she pulls everybody back in, and then she sends me out, and then she sends them out and brings me back in and says, "You're going to get your daughter, and we're going to give you the Social Security so you can help take care of her and become, you know, do what you need to do." And so all those years, you know, of listening to a sponsor and a home group and following some guidance. Now, I wish I could say that I always did. I didn't, you know. But in those particular times, sometimes there were times where God showed up, you know. And if I want to believe that looking at my daughter, you know, as I take her back and we stop in St. Louis, Missouri, and we stop in Memphis, if I want to believe that's my God talking to me, I can, you know, because I've learned that God comes through people, places, and things. And it isn't just one fixated thing. Sometimes it's a sunrise. And I used to call Barstow the worst place in the world. And that's where I found God, you know, rather I should say it's where he allowed me to find myself and sobriety. And so working through all of that and becoming a father and then getting divorced and then finishing out recruiting duty and still making bad decisions, you know, financially. And I wish I could say that sobriety has always been perfect, but it hasn't. I've been through some surrenders, had some white flags, you know, a lot of white flags. That the one thing that always stuck in my head, there was my grand sponsor, his name is Keith Drum. The last thing Keith Drum said to me in 1999 when I left California was, and I won't say the whole quote, but he's like, "What the F are you going to do?" And then walked away. And that's the kind of guidance I got, you know, because it's a thinking kind of guidance. It's like, "Well, what am I going to do?" Well, I know how to go to meetings. I know how to work with people. I know how to work the steps. I know how to get out of myself. You know, I know how to do all those things. I know how to take my daily inventories. And that's what I love about the 12th step, you know, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. We try to carry this message to other alcoholics. And that message, you know, for a lot of years, I thought I understood that, but really, it's what did I get out of the steps that I could share with somebody, you know, one-on-one with somebody, and sometimes at a meeting. And so, you know, I don't know sometimes, and sometimes things just come out. And I'm not a big book quoter, and at times the stuff will come out of my mouth that's out of the big book, and I'm like, man, how do I remember that? Because I don't remember anything except all of the stuff I wrote in my fourth step, all of the stuff I wrote in my fourth step, and all of the stuff that I continue to write in four steps to this day. And I still do four steps all the time. And that's what my sponsor now, whose name is Ruben, tells me. You know, when I call him with what I think is the worst thing in the world, and he laughs. He's like, do some writing, I do a four step, then call me. Send me the writing. I don't want to do that, you know, because my defects pop out and I'm lazy and I'm slothful. Man, you know, the sad part, and it's not sad, we were talking about this the other day, and it might have been yesterday or today, you know, is that when my defects rear, I know where they are already, you know, I already know. And it's funny how you got to get into them. And, you know, today I have recovery in my home. My wife is a grateful member in recovery in Al-Anon, and she's got, I'm going to screw this up, because 20 years, 21 years, and her anniversary is November 10th. She was going out and out before she and I met. I left that part out of the story. Part of it was is she and I met and fell in love long distantly, and I got to learn how to be a friend. I finally started doing a relationship the right way, you know, and I don't know if doing it long distance is the right way, but when I say the right way, meaning that it wasn't always just about sex, and it wasn't always about the selfishness of me, because I'm a selfish, self-centered, egotistical SOB. And, you know, and I'm that way, not just with my wife. I'm that way with my kids. I'm that way with the guys I sponsor. I'm that way with AA, you know, because this is a program that I have to constantly work. And I was having that conversation earlier. I can't remember her name, saved my life, with the gentleman earlier. And we were talking about it. You know, I don't know how to differentiate the difference between AA and life anymore, because it is my life. You know, sobriety is my life, and there is recovery. And it isn't that my wife needs Al-Anon. She chooses to go to Al-Anon because she knows she needs it, but moreover, she wants it, you know, and that supports my sobriety. She supports me, and she supports recovery and home and family, you know, and I don't know. I don't have all the answers today, and I'm grateful because she has a sponsor who has a sponsor. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I get the privilege to sponsor some guys today, who get to sponsor some guys, you know. And a few years ago, it'll be 3 years coming up, I started a meeting in my basement right after COVID, because I felt like, you know, meetings were just stagnant for me. And I'm not saying that the meetings were wrong. I'm not saying they were bad. I was going through a lot. It was one of those white flag moments. And I said, you know what, you know, we create that which we crave. And I started a men's meeting because I didn't want to just sit in mixed meetings and not be able to still be a man, you know, and have those conversations that men need to have, because women need to sit in meetings with women and have conversations women need to have. And I'm a firm believer in that. And that's not being misogynistic, and that's not being egotistical. That's being practical and realistic. And that's what sobriety has taught me. Men sponsor men and women sponsor women. And I talk about sponsorship a lot. And I say it, and nowhere in the big book does it say it. I think it's one of those unwritten rules, and I can't tell you where it first started, and I can't tell you why, but I think I can tell you why, because we can't do this alone. And when you think about the founders and how they stayed sober, and in the years that they learned and they sponsored and they learned how to do things, and they did those things and they etched them all. And then, you know, just like it talks about, what they did is they hammered it out on the anvils of experience. And I'm grateful for that. That's one of the few sayings that I do remember always, because they did the hard work in anvils. You know, that's a hard job. And looking at that, and also looking at the ladies and the women that stood behind those men in the early days and made the coffee, cleaned up beds, and made sandwiches, you know, and not just in the Al-Anons, but the ladies today who struggle in sobriety, probably a lot harder, in my opinion, and that's where I will only say my opinion, than men do, because there are more sober men than there are sober women. And that's why it's important for women to link up with other women, in my opinion. Why? Because men are sick. I don't know about y'all, but I know I am. And that's my 45-minute marker. So sorry about that. So, you know, looking at it from that perspective, you know, I sponsor guys and I tell them you can sponsor whoever you want, but I suggest you sponsor men. And I suggest you take men through the steps. And that's not to say you can't have friends in sobriety who are ladies, you know, and it's a lady who got me to come share here, you know, because we go to a meeting on Wednesday night in Remington. And I don't talk to a whole lot of ladies, you know, because sometimes I can filter through the BS. And that's one thing I've learned in 27 years is how to filter through and how to listen. Not that I look down upon anybody or that. I learned to have compassion and I learned to pray for others, you know, because they just haven't found it yet, you know, and they're just not ready, you know. And I learned to realize that that's what compassion is and how I've learned that, you know. And I tell you what, if you ever want to learn how your defects go, just work with some other alcoholics, man. God will put those people where they have the biggest defects that you have glaring right back at you. And then you've got to say, man, I got to be an example. You know, so that's the funny part about how God works and how my higher power, whom I choose to call God today. You know, so I don't know that I've shared anything that might have helped someone. I know that it's helped me tonight, and I'm honored. It's always an honor and a privilege to be able to come share my story. And it went nothing like I saw it in my head. And I really thought there would probably only be about 5 or 6 people, and I didn't think people on Zoom would be there. So hello to all you out there. And, you know, I'll say this and shut up. You know, we do our men's group meeting on Thursdays. It's a book study. And, you know, we read the big book completely through, and then we go through the 12 steps and traditions, and then we start over, you know. And it's a place for men that can go in and share about their experience, strength, and hope, and learn what it is to stay sober by the basic texts and those things. And there's nothing more and nothing less. And I'm blessed, you know. My children support me today. I got my daughter here, Celine. She doesn't go to Alateen. Sometimes I think she's been to a few. I haven't forced my kids to do any of that. My other 14-year-old, she chooses to go to Alateen sometimes. And my 18-year-old, who's still at home, she has no desire to even look at that capacity. And then my oldest, who's 27, you know, we've gotten to have a better relationship and today. And, you know, she supports my sobriety in the best way that she can. And I'm grateful, you know, because I don't control anything. I can only control the choices I make based off of the influences that I hope God gives me, you know. So this is a great little place. I love the ride out. It's a beautiful country. I love it. Getting able to see it during the day. And, you know, we go out to Remington, and I always say this, and the guys I sponsor will say that. I'll say this and shut up. You know, we get to take a panel out to Boxwood on Monday nights, and I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that we got to be able to have that foot in the door, you know, and to just be able to go. You know, I didn't get sober in a detox. I didn't get sober in a place like that. And I'm grateful they have places like that, you know, for people that get to go there and have an opportunity to have a foundation started. You know, the odds are stacked against them and the statistics. And that was one of the things I didn't want to be, was a statistic. And I know there's a couple people that go to the Remington meeting that are successful in sobriety after Boxwood. And they made, you know, quite sure to tell me that when I visit Remington sometime. I'm like, well, I don't know if there's anybody that stayed sober from Boxwood. But they do, you know, and that's the funny thing about it is that staying sober and what sobriety is. What is sobriety? Well, it's this. It's experience, strength, and hope shared with other alcoholics of like-mindedness, you know, looking for a solution to stay sober and understanding what that word means and not just having it as just a word, but an action, you know, action. Last thing I'll say is my sponsor always told me is take action or die. And that's how I look at sobriety today. I can't afford to look at it any other way other than life or death. And I don't have to survive today. Today I get to live. You know, I have recovery in my home, and I'm grateful. I'm grateful. You know, so I appreciate you letting me come and share my story. Thanks for letting me share.